You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The Pacific Ocean is our state's vast neighbor to the west, helping shape our history and identity as a state. So we're going to take some time to explore the California coast and our relationship with it. The coast is where more than 26 million Californians call home and entices millions more to visit its cliffs and beaches. But a study released this month by the U.S. Geological Survey reveals that many of the state's iconic beaches and seascapes could be gone or look drastically different by the end of this century due to rising sea levels. This is just one of many challenges facing the state's coast, with ramifications that could impact those who live far beyond its shores. Dr. Amber May heads the California Council on Science and Technology and joins us to help us better understand these challenges and share how she's working towards solutions to preserve California's world-famous coast. Good morning.
Good morning, Vicky.
So, Amber, long before your work advising state policymakers, you began your career as an ocean scientist. When did you first become fascinated by the ocean, and how did your career in this field really begin?
As far back as I can remember, I was very lucky to grow up in the Bay Area, camping along the shoreline and hiking in the creeks. And I had an opportunity to go to camp once when I was a child. My family didn't have a lot of money, so I got to pick one camp opportunity, and I picked a sea-focus camp. I got to go to the Marin Headlands and the Farallon Islands, which are just off the coast of San Francisco, and I was hooked. It was amazing.
One of the highlights of your career, I mean, you've checked off a lot of pretty cool, like, bucket list things when it comes to the ocean, but you went on this scuba diving expedition to find the oldest known shipwreck off the California coast, and this was back in, I think, like, 1998. What can you share with us about that really kind of, like, unparalleled experience? I think a majority of people will not experience that in their life.
Yes, I was so lucky to be a part of this incredible expedition. Such a talented group of people from the National Park Service, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, National Marine Sanctuary Program, coming together to explore the history of the California coast. This ship, the San Agustin, was known to traverse the California coastline, and it sunk in 1595 in Drake's Bay out near Point Reyes. And we knew approximately where it was, but it was covered by sediments for centuries. And so we were out exploring how to discover it, uncover it potentially. And our expedition was all about the technology needed to do this safely. So I ended up being on the shark team because Drake's Bay also is inhabited by great white sharks. It's a feeding area because Wow. There are a lot of seals and sea lions there, which are some of the favorite foods of the white sharks. And so my team was working on deploying a big shark net so that the people who were doing the exploration could work safely inside the shark net. But in being on that team, it meant I was deploying the shark net from the outside. So most of my time in the water was on the outside of the shark net.
How did an experience like that, exploring a ship from centuries ago, from 1595, and looking at it, in present day off, the California coast at that time, how did that deepen your understanding of our relationship with the ocean?
It just reminds us that we have such a long and deep history, and so much of that history is the indigenous history, the people who came across the land bridge into North America thousands and thousands of years ago and have just been incredible stewards of the land. And this shipwreck was a reminder that there were visitors who came later and brought different challenges to our coastline and different stories. And I know a number of people who walk the beaches can find remnants of the past, and that can be a very exciting way to discover the history of the California coastline, and the history is complex.
You mentioned that one camp that you went to as a kid, mm-hmm. and you got to experience, was it the Farallones Island?
Farallones,
yeah. Yes. I had to look that up. I mean, it's actually like kind of in the area of Point Reyes and San Francisco Bay,
yeah.
and Drake's Bay. But as an adult, you actually had an opportunity to revisit it kind of once again. You piloted a submersible to explore the depths of that gulf. How did that journey just even more deepen and enhance your understanding of the ocean?
That was such an incredible opportunity again.
I would imagine it's also full circle, going from like a child to an adult as well.
Yeah, I could not believe it. This was part of a National Geographic expedition. Sylvia Earle was this explorer in residence for National Geographic, and she wanted to explore the national marine sanctuaries around the United States. So California is lucky to have a number of national marine sanctuaries, and the Gulf of the Farallones is part of a national marine sanctuary, and I was working there, and she said, I don't want just scientists to be a part of this expedition. I want people who can go out and then communicate back to the world the importance and the majesty, the mystery, what lies below in the ocean. And so I was part of the outreach team that got to be trained to pilot a one-person submersible. And that day that the big research vessel picked up the tiny submersible off the deck and plunked me into the ocean, I could not believe that I had the chance to explore those depths. It was so incredible to descend down into this 3D world that most people don't have a chance to explore firsthand, and just to be surrounded by the light trickling through the water, the fish, the incredible diversity that's out off our shore.
Given that you have such an intimate relationship and understanding of California's coast, how has it evolved and changed in, you know, the some 30 years when you started this career?
Yeah, so you mentioned some of the challenges that we're seeing. Early in my career, while we were aware of climate change, we weren't fully aware of the direct impacts to the ocean in terms of sea level rise and ocean acidification and heating up the ocean. The ocean can have heat waves as well, and we're facing one of those now. And so much of that new knowledge has helped us understand what we can do to help protect the oceans and why protecting the oceans are so important to us.
So that kind of leads me to what you do now, because you took this career shift away from like literally working in the ocean to becoming a policy advisor. What led to this shift?
I really do deeply care about the ocean. And I say ocean and oceans, and I'll just clarify that a little bit. On the map, you see Pacific Ocean, you see Atlantic Ocean, and Arctic, you see lots of names. And so we think we have many oceans. They're all connected. So it's really all one ocean. So as a clarifying point, and I recognized that if I truly cared about protecting the ocean, I needed to think about what some of the biggest drivers were to impact the ocean. And so much of that comes from land, what we do on land. And climate change is one of the biggest drivers of ocean change and ocean degradation. And so my move to the land side was really to think upstream, how we can reduce pollution into the ocean, including carbon dioxide. And so the work that I've been doing with the California Council on Science and Technology is thinking about how to bring science and technology advice to California policymakers who care about developing policy that's going to be protective of our resources and our people, and ultimately the ocean.
And this policy work of yours goes back years. You were the first science advisor to the state's Ocean Protection Council. You were appointed by Governor Schwarzenegger to be the Assistant Secretary of Coastal Matters for the California Natural Resources Agency, and now you're at the Council of Science and Technology. So a big piece of this, I would imagine, is like translating science for lawmakers. How challenging is that?
It's really, I think about it as policymakers and scientists operating in different worlds. They have different cultures. They speak different languages. They have different incentives. They operate on different time frames. And because I've been lucky enough to be trained as a scientist and work in the science realm and also be trained as a policymaker, act as a policymaker, as an appointed official and as a fellow in California and Washington, D.C., I got to learn how to speak both languages. I got to learn the culture. And so I see myself as a translator between the two. I can understand the constraints and help the two policymaking groups and academic and research groups connect with each other in a meaningful way. And I can help translate the knowledge into something that's more actionable for policymakers to use. Mm.
That brings me to the study that was released this month from the U.S. Geological Survey, and it was detailing the potential impacts of sea levels rising, and that an estimated number of beaches by the end of the century, I mean, it was a decent range from 25% to 70% of beaches, you know, could be drastically changed. They could disappear due to sea level rise. What are the big consequences that you're talking about when you're having conversations today with lawmakers about losing that coastline? And really, I mean, when you think of like the span of like Earth and how long California has been here, that's kind of like a blip. It's a relatively short period.
That's exactly right, Vicky. It is so fast. And I think sometimes people get stuck on these bigger projections looking out to 2100 and thinking, oh, that's so far away. We have so much time. And forgetting that so many of the impacts that we're projecting are occurring now and they're going to get worse. And so we're already seeing coastal flooding. We're already seeing big storms. I mean, we just saw this last
January,
year.
Right.
Yeah, January, all the atmospheric rivers that rolled in. We all know the term atmospheric river now. And, you know, Santa Cruz had some really significant impacts. That's going to continue and it's going to get worse. And so the reports that the USGS put out and other academic and research institutions, we rely on them to help paint the picture of what's to come, and that helps us understand how to build resilience to what we're already seeing as impacts today. And that's the thing that I want to make sure that everybody knows, is that when we think about sea level rise, we need to move away from this idea of a slowly rising bathtub effect that we don't have to worry about too much. Oh, the ocean's getting warmer and it's getting higher. Oh, that doesn't sound so bad. It actually is really a problem, and it's a problem today. Mm. And we're already seeing ecosystems that are changing in really terrible ways because the heat in the ocean has led to cascading effects, loss of kelp forests, loss of structure and ecosystem function that we rely on. The sea levels rising are not just a problem for big waves eroding the beaches, our iconic beaches that we care so much about. They're also driving the groundwater to rise up in some of our urban areas, and that can cause flooding, nuisance flooding. It can also move toxins and get them into the system again in a way that we hadn't predicted. And so there, every day we're learning more about some of the problems that we're facing as the system gets warmer, as the sea levels get higher. And we're also thinking about all the actions that we can take to mitigate those effects.
How do you convey that gravity to, you know, the Californians that don't live in a coastal community? They aren't directly touched by this.
Yeah, so that's another really important point. You as a hiker and a lover of nature and streams and creeks, when I encourage everyone to get out to nature, and when they see a stream or creek or river, the American River here or the Sacramento River, know that that is flooding out to the ocean. And so what goes in it is also going out to the ocean. And what's happening along the ocean, in the ocean along our coast, affects us here too, affects our weather. It affects everything we do. It affects the cost of food. It affects the air that we breathe. It has so many effects, even though it feels somewhat removed.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and we're speaking with Dr. Amber Mace of the California Council on Science and Technology about the state of California's coast and the challenges it faces from human development and climate change. We focused a lot on sea level rise. What other challenges are you concerned about?
I'm concerned about plastics in the ocean. It's heartbreaking when we see these birds and all marine mammals now and marine critters. If you look in their stomachs, they have traces of plastics in them, because as plastic degrades, it gets smaller and smaller, and it's very difficult for ocean critters to distinguish a piece of plastic from a piece of food, a piece of plankton. And so we're seeing animals on beaches when they have died, particularly in the Pacific, these majestic albatross that have bellies full of plastic. And there are so many ways that we can prevent plastic from getting in the system. Some people think, oh, can we just go and clean up that great big garbage patch out in the ocean? It, unfortunately, it's very difficult to do. It's not a big island out there. It's very distributed. So one of the best ways to prevent plastics from getting into the ocean and filling the bellies of the critters that we care about is to prevent it from getting into the system in the first place. And that means reducing our use of single-use plastic bags and other plastic items, thinking about how California can institute policies that reduce all of the trash that's ending up on beaches. People can go and do beach cleanups or coastal cleanups and creek cleanups. All of those make a really big difference.
What do you hear from lawmakers who, you know, they may tell you that, you know, on the surface, they support that, they hear you, but maybe there just isn't the political will to do something about it.
There are always trade-offs when we have to decide how to allocate our time and money. And I think that reminding people about how important the ocean and a healthy ocean is to our own livelihoods is really important. That make the case not just for the fact that it helps feed people, it helps provide jobs for people, it provides the air that we breathe, and it helps absorb the carbon dioxide that we're putting into the system and the heat that we're putting into the system. So we need it to function for us to survive and to thrive.
When it comes to human or just development, you know, and residences along the coast and roads, there's this concept of managed retreat, which is, you know, moving or removing roads, houses, even neighborhoods from a coastline. There are some coastal communities that push back against this idea. Do you think that that is the only option or the best option for these communities?
That is a really challenging option, and it is definitely, I completely understand why there would be pushback for this. There are going to be certain cases where there is not enough room to retreat to because there's something right behind where that community is. There are going to be areas where there are resources available to move and there's a space to move. And then there are going to be some areas where we just decide that it's not going to work and we're just going to have to let nature in. And those are going to be really important conversations to have with each community, and everybody should have a voice in those decisions. And we want to make sure that there are equitable decisions made around this, not just those who have all of the wealth have access to the options that are going to protect their resources.
Given that you've been having these conversations with lawmakers shaping policy for many years, you know, what keeps you doing it? What gives you optimistic that change can happen and maybe not feel demoralized or even kind of apathetic?
I just have to go to the coast. I just have, or get near water, and that is enough. I mean, I just need to be able to see it and breathe deeply and relax, and that's what it does for me. And to continue to discover and learn, that's what inspires me. There's so much mystery still out there. There's so much we don't know, and it's so incredibly beautiful and powerful, and that is what drives me every day.
What can we do on an individual level? Because sometimes this feels like such a big existential challenge. What can a single person do?
Yeah, so many things, but I'll focus on one, and it might not be what you would expect. I will say drive less. And this has very direct impacts because you can reduce the pollution that comes off your brake pads that go directly into the ocean. It also reduces the emissions that come from transportation. And transportation is one of the biggest source of remaining emissions in California. And you might say, but wait, I drive an electric vehicle. And I will say, that's wonderful. Thank you for doing that. You still, if you're driving all the time on a day-to-day basis, are contributing to congestion on the roadways, and that still contributes to emissions. So we can all drive less. I still want you to drive to go to the coast because I want you to be inspired by it. Those special trips are wonderful. If you can think about driving less in your day-to-day, then you'll make a real difference.
There's an equity component when we're talking about transportation, because it may be easier to take public transit or ride a bike in, you know, a city center where they build the infrastructure for that, make it safe and accessible and convenient. And then when you go to other areas that are underserved, you know, it's very difficult to get around. And so what about the argument that you're putting the onus in having that individual shoulder more of that responsibility when arguably, you know, governments aren't stepping up to provide that access?
That's exactly right, Vicki. And that's what we're seeing governments working on. Our state government right now is investing quite a bit in transportation infrastructure, including public transit, and thinking about these underserved communities, how to make it easier, how to make it more affordable for the people in these communities to get to where they need to. And they often are the ones who have to travel the furthest. And so what does that look like to support this type of transportation need? And I'm encouraged, though there's a lot of work that still needs to be done.
Dr. Mace, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you, Vicki.
Dr. Amber Mace is the CEO of the California Council on Science and Technology, discussing the many challenges and some solutions facing our state's coast and potential solutions to overcome them. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.